As far as I'm concerned, it is 8:30, so that means it is time to start the shiur. People will join when they join. Welcome Toby, Judd, and Melissa, and to anyone who's about to log on. So we are on Tes Zayin Amud Aleph. We are on 16a. We are actually in the middle of the Amud. We are on the last small line, Tnan Hasam, right in the middle of the last small line. I do not know what that corresponds to in the art scroll, but you see wherever that gray bar corresponds to the last line.
16A3.
83?
16A3.
16A3. So there you go for everyone who's keeping score. Now let's just orient ourselves for a moment. Tonight's sugya is going to be, we're going to be exploring further the concept of a lav shanite glase. Once again, a very important and critical concept for us to know throughout our journeys in the third parak of Makos is when I have a negative mitzvah, a don't do, followed by an ase, a positive mitzvah. And the most simple understanding that the Gemara actually mentioned is that the ase rectifies the los ase that I performed. We're actually going to have one of my favorite examples come up in the Gemara soon. But if we remember, there was actually a very critical machlokas in the Gemara about, do I have to actually be mekayim? Do I have to fulfill the mitzvahs aseh in order to exempt me from the makos I would incur from the los aseh? Or is it enough just to potentially still have the ability to fulfill the aseh, even if I never do it? Basically, could be nagging me from today to tomorrow, telling me you better fulfill that aseh. I can say, look, I always have the chance to fulfill it, and therefore I won't get malchus. But that means, even according to Bitlu Vlo Bitlu, if I do find a way to nullify and to make it that I no longer have the opportunity or the potential to fulfill the mitzvah aseh, at that point I would get malchus for nullifying or eliminating the possibility to fill the mitzvah's assay. That is all stuff that we learned last time. But it's critical that we remember that going into this Gemara, because our entire discussion tonight will be predicated and surrounding that concept. So before we go forward, literally clarification of what I just said. Is there anything in that that I can clarify that's unclear before we go forward, because our entire Gemara hinges upon this? Judd.
In terms of nullification, is that something that nullifies based action? Or is it nullifying?
Good. So Judd wants to remind us that, you know, when we first were learning through this, we were a little bit uncertain. Do I have to actively eliminate the possibility of fulfilling the assay? Or let's say circumstances just occur that the assay is no longer possible for me to fulfill. So it's a machlokas, Rashi, and the Ritva. This Gemara we're about to learn tonight is going to strongly imply in certain instances that I have to actively be mevatel. I have to actively eliminate the possibility in order for me to incur malchus as a result. So thank you for bringing that up. That's an important idea to think about. Any other just clarification, things that we could just clarify for Lava Nitik Vase, Bitlovo, Bitlo, Kimu Vilo Kimu, any of these things that we could clarify before we go forward? I see a bunch of muted microphones. In case any of you wanted to raise questions, make sure to unmute for a moment. Let's see who else we have. Welcome. Gloria, Zadie, Phyllis, Erwin, Marina. Okay. Gloria, I saw it. Gloria, do you have a question?
No.
Okay.
What page?
We are on 16A. What was to the what power?
Yes.
To the what?
Three.
Power.
Okay, got it.
Very good. So here we go. Tnan Hasam. So this actually is going to be, it's not really citing from there, but this is actually going to be the next Mishnah that we'll get to, God willing, in 2 weeks, I believe. Tanan Hasam, and those actually were in our Friday afternoon Mishnah crowd. We actually got up to that recently in our Mishnayos Mako studies. So you already are ahead of the game if you've heard it. Tanan Hasam, Hanotel Aim Al Habanim. So one of, you know, there's this mitzvah in the Torah. I'm sure we've heard about it. It's a very interesting mitzvah that to send away the mother bird You send away the mother bird, and then you take the eggs that are left in the nest. However, let's say I violated, and instead of shooing away the mother bird, I violated a lo saseh of taking the mother along with the chicks, along with the baby birds in there, the eggs in there. Rabbi Yehuda omer lo kevena mishaleach. Rabbi Yehuda says, I get malchus, and I don't have to send away the mother bird because he just doesn't, he in principle holds of lavanitik la'asei. He just thinks that this particular instance doesn't have an asei following a lo saseh. We don't get hung up on that now. We're going to deal with Mishnah in depth in 2 weeks' time. The Chachamim say this is a quintessential case of a lavanitik la'asei, which is don't take the mother bird along with the children, but in the event you do, send away the mother bird. And Zahaklal, and this is the rule. Anytime that you have a lo saseh followed by an asay that pertains to lo saseh, it comes to exempt me from malchus. That's the Mishnah. All straightforward. Now, Rabbi Yochanan is going to comment. The Amor, a number of years later, Amor Rabbi Yochanan, Eilam Ela Zosur Acheres. Remember, Rabbi Yochanan is a proponent of the Bitluv Lo Bitlo camp. In fact, he's kind of the spokesman for it. Rabbi Yochanan believes the only time you get Malchus in the Lav Nidhi Glaseh is when you are Mevatel, you eliminate the possibility to fulfill the assay altogether. You don't have to actually fulfill it, but you have to have the potential to fulfill it. And so Rabbi Yochanan says is there are only two cases where one can actually eliminate the possibility to fulfill the assay of the Lav Nidhi Glaseh. Case number one, we literally just said it. If I were to kill the mother bird, then I would no longer be able to send away the mother bird and fulfill the mitzvah's asay. Makes sense, right? That's case number one. Now, what's case number two? That's Rabbi Elazar's question. Amar Li Rav Elazar, Heicha. So new, where's the other place? You said this case and another mitzvah, it's possible to eliminate the potential to perform them. New, don't just, you know, be vague like that. Tell me what the second one is. Apparently, Rabbi Yochanan like playing games. Amar Li Lechisishkach. You know what? You go out and find the second possibility. All right, so begrudgingly, he's not getting an answer out of Rabbi Yochanan. Nabak dog Feeshkach. He went out, he searched, he researched. He went on Bar Ilan and Utsar Chachma. He Googled around and he found the case. What was the case? The Tanya, we learned it last week. Ones Shagirish, a rapist who marries the woman and then decides to divorce her, which he's not allowed to do. It's a lo saseh. In Yisrael, who machsavina loka. If he's Yisrael, he takes her back, remarries her, and because he remarries her, he doesn't get malchus. The im kohen who lokavina machsav. But if he's a kohen, he gets malchus because he's not allowed to take her back. A kohen's not allowed to marry a divorcee. So comes along Rabbi Eliezer says, maybe this is the second example of a case where you will get malchus for lav anidi glasei when you don't have the possibility of the lo saseh. Why? Well, hanichol amadetani kimu velo kimu. You see, this is all well, according to the opinion that kimu velo kimu. Okay, great. You know, if I don't fulfill, according to the kimu velo kimu camp, if I neglect to remarry this woman after divorcing her, and Basin says, "No, are you going to remarry her?" And I say, "I haven't gotten around to it." Well, off with your head. Lashes. We gave you 39 lashes. But according to Laman, the Tony Bilavlo Bitlu, Bishlamagave, Shiluaka came Mishkakasla. Ela Ones Bilavlo Bitlu, Heki Mishkakasla. But it makes sense. In the case of Shiluaka came, of sending away the mother bird, there it's possible you just kill the mother bird. That's a case where you'll get Malchus for a lava and you think say, because you eliminated the potential to fulfill the assay once you killed the mother bird. no longer send her away once she's dead. However, if I just finish this part,
yeah, sure.
In the case of Ones, but in the case of Ones, it's not as possible. One can't do that. Why? Well, how are you going to eliminate the possibility to fulfill the mitzvahs asay? Because let's say, right, you might be thinking to yourselves, well, if the way I eliminate potential to send away the mother bird and fulfill the mitzvah to say is by killing the mother bird, logically, I would think, what's the analogous option here to eliminate the possibility of fulfilling the essay? By killing the woman. If I kill her, I'll never have to marry her again. The thing is, that's true, you will eliminate the possibility, but if we can just remember to where is that coming from? Okay. Where was I? So it's true, you will no longer be chayiv to marry her. And it's true, you're not going to get malchus either for the losasei that you violated. But you know why you're not getting malchus when you eliminate the possibility to remarry her? Not because you didn't eliminate the lavaniti klasei possibility, but because of our age-old concept, kimle b'derabamine. Because you know why I'm not getting malchus? Because I'm being put to death instead. And this is the principle we learned about at the beginning of the first parak, that kimle b'derabamine tells me that I get hit with the harsher punishment. Lashes isn't lovely, but death is probably worse. In fact, that is how halacha views it. And so what we're left with is, we don't understand. Where is the case of me being mevatel, the possibility for me to fulfill the mitzvah say, whereby I will incur malchus as a result, since I'm no longer able to rectify the low sasay of initially divorcing her? That's the question we have. All right, let me pause for a moment. Any clarification questions?
Yeah, I have a comment on this. I know a rabbi who actually did this. I believe it was with a Canadian goose. And he sent away the mother and took the young, or the egg as the case may be. And he mentioned it to me and wanted to know if he had violated any law, and the answer was yes. We have a Migratory Game Bird Act that is pursuant to a treaty that we have with Canada, maybe also Mexico.
Oh, okay.
So as a cautionary word, don't try to practice it with any migratory game birds.
Okay, that's good advice. I thought what you were about to say was you saw in real life that someone actually murdered the woman that he raped and then divorced her and then killed her, so he wouldn't have to remarry her. But Baruch Hashem, it was the first case that you witnessed. Hopefully, certainly the second one, we hope it never occurs.
So that guy would get stoned.
Well, not stoning per se, but okay. Phyllis, you had a question.
Yeah, yes. I was wondering, why would they use the Kohen as an example when we know, and the Kohen knows that he's not allowed to marry a divorced woman. And so if he divorced her, we assume that he wanted to divorce her and not to remarry her?
Well, that's why the Kohen's the exception to the rule. The Kohen actually does get malchus because he doesn't have the initial potential to fulfill the mitzvah sase of taking her back, because it's forbidden for a Kohen to marry the Grusha.
So we're not actually
talking about the Kohen. We're talking about the Yisrael.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad that we clarified that.
Thank you.
Okay. So now let's just reorient ourselves. We're actually in middle of a shock of Ataria, and I just want to get a few lines down to the end of this piece for my own sake, so I don't lose the train of thought. So you'll just bear with me. So again, what are we trying to solve here? Rav Yochanan said there are only two cases where one can eliminate the possibility to fulfill a mitzvah asay, whereby they will incur malchus for eliminating that possibility. They'll get malchus because they eliminated the assay. So case number one, we said, was killing the mother bird. Case number two, Rabbi Elazar suggested, was the case of the rapist divorcing the woman, but What is the scenario where I eliminate the potential to fulfill the mitzvah saseh? So maybe the same way you kill a mother bird, you can't fulfill the mitzvah, you kill the woman, you can't fulfill the mitzvah. The issue is, but you're not going to get malchus. We're looking for a case where you get malchus as a result. You're going to get capital punishment as a result. So that's not a good case. So Rashi Mechuzna, an alternative suggestion, you know what? This guy, he raped her, he divorced her, but you know what? He wants to make amends. So what's he going to do? For her second husband, he's going to be her agent. He's going to be her shliach for kiddushin, and he'll be the one who accepts the document or the ring, whatever it is, from the man on her behalf in order to facilitate her betrothal to a different man. Ah, so maybe that's a case where he eliminates the possibility to remarry her once she's engaged, she's betrothed through kiddushin to another man. She's off the market. She's not muteris. Literally, that's how we call an aleph, muteris lashuk. So he's not allowed to marry her now. So maybe that's a case where somebody eliminates the possibility to be machzer kushaso to take back the woman that he divorced.
So he gets
the issue man. Is the issue is amarav isha vasei shliach. Either way, it doesn't make sense. If she appointed him as her agent, we say shluchel shel adam kamoso. My agent in halach, my shliach, is like me. So if she appointed him to betroth her to another man, we don't view it as him performing the deed. We view it as the woman performing the deed, and he's just doing it on her behalf. So he's not being mavat. This guy's here for John. He's not being mevatel. He's not actively being mevatel the possibility of him remarrying her. She's being mevatel it. So we still don't have our case of someone actively dissolving the possibility of fulfilling the essay. And okay, ilo shavise shliach. And of course, if she didn't appoint him as her agent, he just did it out of his own goodwill, a good Samaritan who wants to help her out. Kol kimine, lo klumhi. Well, shkoyach, if I never chose you to be my shliach, you're not allowed to be my shliach for me. So again, we're still stuck. We're still searching for a case where the husband, the guy, the rapist, he could actively be mevatel the possibility of remarrying. So let's try another possibility, another route. Maybe, let's say he took a neder, he took an oath in public saying, I hereby take an oath that I will not have any benefit from this woman. Meaning, he can't be married to her now. Ah, so there, he's actively dissolving any possibility of him remarrying her because he literally took an oath not to benefit from her. So, the issue is, as we know, Rosh Hashanah is around the corner. We take oaths, but certain oaths are subject to hataras nedarim. So, what was that? It's a nullification, exactly. So, anich lamad davar neder shgita b'rabim mi malafara. So, okay, this is a stam neder, by the way, we're talking about. This is a neder that I didn't just make to myself, but I made it publicly. So, a neder I make publicly has a higher halakhic force than just a nether that I'll randomly say on my own out loud. So it's a machlokis action. This is all fine and dandy, according to the opinion. It says that once someone makes a public oath, it's irrevocable. But according to Elamandamar Yeshua Hafara, Ma'ikal Neymar, but according to Mandamar, who says you could nullify, you could annul a public vow, then we're still back to square one. He hasn't truly nullified the possibility of remarrying her because he could always get that vow annulled. So the Gemara says, you know what? Let's crank this up a notch. Demedirala al das rabim. Not just simply he took a vow publicly, but he took a vow al das rabim with the consent and the buy-in of the people who are listening. It wasn't simply I took a vow and you're all witnessing me taking the vow. The public who heard me take the vow, they were in on that. They're like, we want you to take that vow. This is a vow that we are basically encouraging you, if not forcing per se, but we are strongly encouraging you, and we want you to be taking that vow. So that Amar Amemar Hilchus and Neder Shudu Barabim Yesh Lo Hafara Al Das Rabim Ein Lo Hafara. So even according to the Ma'at number says a public vow could still be annulled. A vow that was done with the consent of the Rabim Al Das Rabim with their participation, that's something that's irrevocable. And if he takes a vow not to benefit from his wife, Al Das Rabim, then he has truly nullified any possibility of remarrying this woman. And that would be the case where I get Malkus for nullifying and dissolving any potential possibility of me performing the mitzvah, say. That, in theory, would be case number two, Rav Yochanan, where I am a vatal, the assay, and thereby receive Malkus. Now, very briefly, I'm going to pause for a question just a moment, but very briefly, why would the rabbin buy into this? Why would the public care to facilitate this? Any ideas?
Yeah. They know the situation between he and the woman, and they don't want to see her being stuck with this guy again.
Zadie, that's intuitively what I would have thought. But actually, Rashi suggests the opposite. A very puzzling Rashi, by the way. Rashi says, Das Rabim, second line from the bottom, Shematzaba Avon Shasurala. You know what? As if like he wasn't the bad guy here already. He found out that this woman wasn't faithful to him. I mean, go figure. He raped her. You know, like, I'm not obviously not justifying her behavior either, but you know, this is obviously a little bit of a messed up relationship to begin with. So, but if he heard through one witness, or he heard like, you know, she just acts in a licentious manner, but not enough that it would allow the court to take any action, he should divorce her. So there, that would be a case where the rabbin would be interested in seeing him take such a net or take such a vow. So that's, but the issue is Tosis takes issue with that. Tosis says, you know, look, if she's really doing something bad, then he doesn't need to take a nether. He's not chayev to remarry her to begin with if she was unfaithful. So a whole entire sugi behind it is Tosis di Ramaskol Kagon, and you can look at Tosis there, all the ensuing mefarshim on there, beyond the scope of our discussion right now, but during your free time, it's a lovely sugi to look into. Okay. Clarification questions. Anything I could just clarify at this point, because we still have a little ground to cover. Is anything unclear?
Yeah. Well, one thing occurred to me. If he divorces her and she remarries, he's forbidden to remarry her if she's divorced. Under any circumstances, a husband cannot take back a wife who subsequently married somebody else.
Very good, Zadie. And this really gets to the heart of Judd's question at the beginning, which is it sufficient for the circumstances to occur that I'm no longer able to fulfill the mitzvah say, or do I have to actively be mevatel the possibility of fulfilling that say? This Gemara, Zadie, as you're pointing out, suggests that I have to actively be mevatel and nullify any possibility of fulfilling the say. So therefore, if she's the one who remarries, it's not his problem because he wasn't mevatel the say. That's why the Gemara is going through all of these acrobatics to figure out a case where he actively is mevatel the assay. Because it wouldn't be sufficient. If she appointed him as a shliach, she's the one really who's orchestrating things. If she herself nullifies it, it's not his loss. He hasn't been mevatel the assay, and he would not get malchus as a result. So that's why we're not giving these more straightforward cases like you're suggesting. Okay. But the Gemara is not satisfied at this point because it asks afterwards, Vesuleika, you mean to tell me out of Kol HaTayra Kula, these are the only two cases of a lav hanitek ba'aseh that you could conceive of the perpetrator being mevatel, the possibility of fulfilling the aseh? I'll give you a few more examples. Here's two right off the bat the Gemara tells us. We have the classic example of theft. If I steal, in the event I violate the laws that save stealing, I have a mitzvah say, to return that which I stole, to which I always love to reference the Chumra video, which was a Purim Shkila, came out probably a decade ago by now, where the Yeshiva Bacharim, they did a Chumra video. This guy who like came up with fake Chumras, fake stringencies. So I said this one before. The line goes, I stole a ring from my Kainta Baila just so I can be Makayim Bahai Shivis Exila. So he said, like, you know, I stole from my Aunt Bela's so I could be fulfill the mitzvah. I really want to fulfill the mitzvah to say of returning that which was stolen. So I stole in order to fulfill the mitzvah, right? That was the logic. So this is a great example of Lafanitik Lassay. And also, Hamashkom, Drachmana Amar Lo Sova Beis Lavuravoto. So, and the other example is a collateral. The in certain instances, the Torah forbids taking a collateral if it's an item that the pauper requires to live. You're not allowed to take that as a collateral. And you're not supposed to like charge into his house and take a collateral either. In the event you do that and you violate and take a mashkon, you take a collateral in that instance, you have a mitzvah say to return it. So Bakimu Mishkachasla Bakimu Lakimu Bitlubo Bitlu. And either school of thought works here. Either Basin says, new, are you going to return the lost the stolen object? If I say no, I get Malchus according to the Kimu Lakimu camp. According to the Bitlubo Bitlu camp, when do I get Malchus? Very simple. Remember how we talked about killing a mother bird? No longer possibility of fulfilling the mitzvah say. Similar idea here. If I burn the stolen object or the collateral, I cannot fulfill the mitzvah say anymore. Now you might be asking, wait a minute, but what if I return the monetary worth? Wouldn't I be fulfilling the mitzvah say? So all right, we'd have to discuss that. But it would seem the Gemara is assuming that if I burn, I destroy that object that I stole from you, I can no longer fulfill the essay of returning it to you if it's been rendered to dust. So there's another great example of being mevatel an assay, and as a result, getting malchus. So why is Rabbi Yochanan telling us it's only two cases in the entire Torah where I could nullify the possibility of fulfilling the positive mitzvah, thereby resulting in malchus? Judge, yeah.
And if a friend of the pauper steals it from him, can't return it either.
Well, he always has the possibility of recovering the item so long as it still exists. Judge asking, what if someone steals from the thief? Oh, and it brings it back to the original person. But again, Judge, you see, this is like what my grandfather brought up also. That's an instance where somebody was mevatel the opportunity for me, but I wasn't actively mevatel it myself. So that's, again, why we're doing all this gymnastics here. According to Kimu Lo Kimu, great. According to Bilu Bitlu, not as much.
So that would be different. That would result in Malchus.
It would not result in Malchus if I didn't actively destroy it. It wouldn't, because another person rendered the situation that I no longer have an opportunity to fill the essay. But it wasn't me who rendered that situation as such. I have to be the one who am avatar, is what the Gemara seems to imply. Now, I know he says, Machlokes Rishonim. This Gemara suggests heavily, I think it was Shitas Rashi. So what's the answer to it? We have so many more cases. I easily found you a case of theft where someone could be mevatel the possibility of returning the stolen object, thus getting malchus. Well, that's not true, really, because if we know the halacha, Hashem came with the chayv tashlumin ein loku mishalim, because I'm paying you back for the lost object, I don't get malchus. Because remember, I only get one punishment. Many times I might get malchus sometimes and not pay. In this instance, I give tashlumin, I pay restitution, but I don't get malchus. So even if I destroy the object I stole, I still only provide restitution, tashlumin, I don't get malchus as a result. So yes, you know, actually it's true. You could be mevatel the opportunity to fulfill that assay, but in these cases, you only pay back restitution, you give compensation, you don't get malchus. We're looking for a case where you're mevatel the assay, and as a result, you get malchus. That we still have not found. But you know what? Rabbi Zera says, wait a minute. Maskiv la Rabbi Zera ha'ika mashkar shal ger v'mei sager. We have a case where let's say, so we know when a person converts to Judaism from a halachic standpoint, they have no family. They are no longer related to their father, to their mother, to their brother, their sister, their dog, his dog's aunt. Well, they're never in the first place. But you get the point. So if a ger dies, the Yerusha doesn't go to anybody. There's no one halachically who by default inherits from a ger. So what happens is, you know, it's interesting. When a ger dies, like the money kind of just goes into this this twilight zone. So what Rabbi Zera is saying is, Ha'igam Ashkon Shal Ger V'Meis Ager. So what Rabbi Zera is saying is, why don't I get Malkus when I destroy the law, when I destroy the stolen object? Because I have to pay back. Here's the case. If it's a ger who I owe the money to, and the ger died, I don't owe him money. I don't owe money to anybody. There are no Yorshim. There are no inheritors. There are no heirs. So I should get Malkus as a result. There we go. And so there's another case where I get Malkus for being about to say, turning the page. But no. Ah, here's some beautiful lumbus from the Gemara. Really, the etzem, in principle, in essence, I am actually chayv to pay restitution. It just happens to be I have no one to pay restitution to. Awesome, Galvar Tashluminu. Here, I am a chayiv in paying money. But the Shibuda de Ger who decapaka, but it was the Ger who died and thereby removed himself from the equation. But really, I'm a chayiv to pay restitution. I'm obligated to pay. It's just the Ger, the recipient, is no longer here and there's no address for me to deliver that. Point being is, this is not a case where I get Malkus for being mevatel the assay. So, okay, we're still down to two possibilities. We're still down to either shluach against sending away the mother bird, or only it's a case of rape where someone's mevatel the possibility of filling the assay, thus incurring Malkus. But the Gemara has one more possibility. One more possibility. But before we go to that next part, that's just a good pausing point. Any questions?
Yeah.
Who's talking?
Toby.
Toby, okay.
Yeah, this is the question's a little bit off maybe, but is there no such thing? I understand that the proselyte heirs don't take because technically they're no longer heirs. But is there no such thing as a will where you can say, I'm leaving my estate to Joe Schmo? So it's not based upon relationship. It's just my document says I want to leave to so-and-so. So then isn't there still the obligation to repay?
So you are correct, Toby. There is something called the will at Safa that we had a wonderful Scott Resnick's presentation on, which I know you're aware from the Base of America. And it definitely is Ruin Halacha. We have also this idea that the last request of a Shchiv Meira, someone who's on his deathbed, there's a mitzvah l'kayim divrei hanes that we fulfill a person's dying wishes. So you're right. In theory, there are mechanisms in place to ensure that, you know, the ger's estate doesn't just go to nobody. But in terms of who this person would owe restitution to, even in the event that he did command that his estate go to someone specific, I don't believe that this individual would owe restitution to that person. Because that person is not an heir. That person is just a person who received a matana, who received a gift from the ger. Does that make sense?
If there's no will, then it's a good example.
Right. It's a good example if there's no will. But if there is,
even if there is a will, when I give my estate to somebody through a will, it doesn't necessarily make them an heir, right? If we do life and legacy, and actually, I still don't understand how these things work fully. But let's just be oversimplifying. You'll tell me that I got this wrong, right? So if I pledge a certain amount of money and it goes to a good shalom doesn't all of a sudden become my heir because I promised to give a donation in my will to a good shalom. I just gave.
No, you're right. In other words, it doesn't. Right, an heir is by operation of law. and there's some kind of relationship.
Yeah.
Aguda Shalom is by virtue of the contract only.
And that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
If a giver decides to give the state to somebody else, that doesn't render the person an heir. It just makes the person recipient of a gift. That's the point.
But you're saying, so this Gemara only makes it contingent upon there being an heir.
Well, because this is restitution. I owe this person money. So I think, you know, if they're Yorshim, if he had relatives who were heirs, I would then owe it to them instead. But here, there's no one who really continues his family line. That's why the gear system.
It'd be like in American law, if I were a beneficiary under the will, whether I'm related or not, I believe I could go after, this is not my area of law, but what I kind of vaguely think is that I could go after a creditor for the money. Because if I'm going to get nothing because the estate has nothing and you owe the estate money.
Interesting. The difference there, this would be a case in theory where the ger owed me money. And the ger's estate doesn't have enough to compensate me because you didn't give restitution to the ger. That's what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, it's possible. I have to think more about it, but I think potentially in that case, if we're dealing with, you know, shibude karka, we're dealing with a lien on land, it's possible that a debtor can come and collect. That's true. But definitely, I don't think the Gemara is conceiving of a case with all those factors.
Thank you.
That enhances our learning. Okay, but just bring it back in. This is the final stretch of the Gemara. The final stretch of the Gemara is, maybe there is one more case we could conceive of, at least one more case. By the way, you know, I have this beautiful Gemara here. It's called the Masifta Gemara. And what it does is, in addition to just explaining the Gemara, it has a section in the back called the Yalkabirim, which is like any material you could like ever want, Rishonim, Achronim, and Gemara. They somehow compiled almost everything that you could want. And in there, they have all these different kinds of questions about different potential possibilities that the Gemara doesn't even entertain, where someone could be Mavatal and not say for Lavi Viglase. So again, if anyone wants to borrow from me at some point and read through all different possibilities, you're welcome to. Certainly, it's a separate shear into itself. But okay, but here's one more example. And it's a case of payah. What's payah? Pay is the obligation for me to leave a corner of my field for the destitute to come and to collect food from there. Va'ika payah. Drachmana amar lo sechala pa'asidecha. Lani la gerita zovosam. So, one is not supposed to take away the corner of their field. And in the event they do, they should make sure to give the equivalent amount of food from that harvest to the poor. So that's a case of a lav anything I say. Don't remove the corner of your field. If any you do, make sure that you give to the pauper. So, so the Mishkach is on the Kimu Lokimu, Bitlu Vlo Bitlu. It definitely makes sense. We have Kimu Lokimu. If I don't fulfill the mitzvah sasei of giving to the poor that which is owed to them, basically will give me Malkus. And according to the school of thought of Bitlu Vlo Bitlu, so that's what we're going to talk about right now. The Tanan, mitzvah pay lahavish min hakama. Lo hifrish min hakama, mafrish min haomer. So the mitzvah of peya is to designate grain that's standing in the ground, that grain, those sheaves are still in the ground, go to the poor. If I already harvested them, then, so then, step number two, b'di'eved, I can take the sheaves which I already cut from the field and give them to the poor. Lo hifrish min ha'omrin, if I didn't give it to them at that stage, the next stage in the process is gathering all the sheaves together, putting them in a pile where they're all stored together. So at that stage also, before I smooth out the pile and make it ready for storage, that is still an opportunity to fulfill the mitzvah asay of giving to the poor to be to rectify the lo saseh of not initially cordoning off a part of my field. Merecho, but let's say I already smoothed it out. I'm done with that part of the process. At that point, I'm chayiv. That's the point in the process where I'm obligated to start giving meiser, to start giving tithes, 10%. So the issue is that at this point in the process, if I give the payah to the pauper, to the ani, they're going to actually lose 10% of that payah because they'll have to take meiser off of it. So you know what I'm supposed to do actually? I have to take meiser off it first, and then I give the ani, I give the pauper from the payah. So I'm actually losing out on it. It happens to be, I would never have to take meiser off it to begin with. If I left a corner of that field to the ani, I would never have to take meiser off that crate. Now I'm losing out. I have to take off meiser and then make sure that the ani still gets what he would have gotten otherwise. But what we see from here is a case where if I go past this stage and I actually process and I start crushing the kernels and I start turning it into flour, once I go one step further in the process, then I lose the opportunity to fulfill the assay of paying the ani, the payah that is owed to him, that is due to him. So there's a case where I could be mevatel the assay and I should be getting malchus as a result for not initially leaving that corner of the field to the ani. So why didn't Rabbi Yochanan say there are at least three cases where I could be mevatel the assay? So maybe because we look at Rabbi Shmuel, Damar Ath Mavrish Min Isa. Rabbi Shmuel has this radical opinion. Even when it's a piece of dough, you've gone so far through the process that it's already a dough, you could still take a piece off and give it as payah to the ani. But even according to Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Shmuel namish mishkan so to achal isa. But you know what? If I already ate all of the bread that could be made from that corner of the field, I've lost the opportunity. I've been the vatal opportunity to fulfill the assay of giving that corner of the field to the ani, to the pauper. So even according to Rabbi Shmuel, who has a more liberal interpretation when he can still fulfill the assay, if I eat and I consume all of it, even Rabbi Shmuel would agree, I no longer have a chance to fulfill the assay because, well, now it's no longer in this world. So what are we going to do? Rabbi Yochanan said there are only two cases. I see three. Shlua HaKain, sending away the mother bird. Ones, the case of the rapist taking her back after divorcing her. And the case of Peya, of giving to the ani after I do not leave a corner of the field. So how do we have two? So the Gemara says, Elazos Oracheres Aha. We're going to end up with Shilua HaKain, sending away the mother bird, and Peya as our two cases. Why? Aval Ones Lo. Why are we kicking out the case of Ones, of rape? Because we actually say in the end of the day, but the difference here is, yes, generally, if I take an oath, al das rabim, with the buy-in of all the people present, of the public present, that I am ossering something, I'm prohibiting something to myself, generally, it's irrevocable. However, in a case that it's for a dvar mitzvah, where this neder is preventing me from performing a mitzvah, i.e. of taking this woman back, there's still a possibility to annul even that vow because it's for a dvar mitzvah, for a mitzvah purpose. Therefore, there is no instance where a person could actually completely nullify the possibility of remarrying this woman that would incur malchus as a result. It might incur death penalty if you kill her, but you're not going to get malchus as a result. And what's a good example of where we could actually revoke a public vow that was done with the consent of everyone? There was a children's teacher who, the word pasha, there's two interpretations of the Rishonim. Either means he he, you know, just hit them too hard with the stick, or it with, you know, with like the measuring stick, they whack them with it. I don't know why I'm telling you guys this. I didn't experience it growing up. I'm sure some of you here experienced it growing up. Hopefully not, but chances are if anyone did, it wasn't me. So either that, or he just wasn't, they thought he wasn't competent enough. Like Pasha's negligence, Pshia, meaning he wasn't careful enough to assess the students and make sure that they were retaining that which they were learning. You know, two radically different ways to understand it. So what happened? Adria Vachla, Rav Acha made sure that there was a neder that they can that he can never teach the children again. That was a public vow with the buy-in of the public. But then Vahadri Rabina came and said, you know what? I'm revoking this. Why? It turned out in the end, they couldn't find somebody that was as good as him. So because of that, for Dvar Mitzvah, for a mitzvah purpose, we were able to revoke that neder. Now, well, just hold on one moment. I want to share with you something. This is such an odd idea. Why is it when it comes to the Dvar Mitzvah, we're able to revoke such a vow? By the way, you know, when we talk about minhagim, we talk about customs that we have. So there's minhagim that I could take upon myself. I could take on a minhag tova, like a chumrah for myself, personal thing. I could do atar sandarim for that. But the issue is, when a whole community takes on a certain minhag, it's much harder to revoke that. Because we were just talking about it. A minhag that's done al das rabin, with everyone's consent and buy-in, that's much harder to revoke halachically. And if you can imagine, let's say the entire Ashkenazic community takes on something like kitnios. It's also, if you can't revoke a vow unless everybody who was involved in it consents to the revocation of that vow. Good luck finding every last Ashkenazi person out there who's willing to say, I mean, I don't know, maybe, you know, like there's going to be like that one guy out there who's like, you know what? I really love not having kitnios on Pesach. Like, there's going to be that one guy who just ruins it for all of us. So what's going on here in the Gemara? Very briefly, one idea here is that we have an Anan Sahad that so long, because when every, why is it Dvar Mitzvah different? So one is that there's an Anan Sahadi, that the Ramban says that we know, we don't say it out loud, but it's obvious to us that in order to perform a mitzvah, we wouldn't want to take on such a vow. When we take on this minhag or this vow, we do it the understanding that it's going to contravene the possibility of performing a mitzvah. You don't want that nether to be out. That's one understanding. Another understanding, which is presented by the Rashba, is that when there is a toeles, when there is a benefit for the public, that's when you're able to revoke a neder. The issue is, he asks, that works in the case of the school teacher. We need a school teacher to teach all the children. But do we really need this guy who's a rapist to marry that woman again? So why would his vow be subject to revocation then? So that's a question that he leaves us with. One other understanding, which is presented by the Meiri says, Rav Amakom Shebashas Aneder HaYodim Shintanit Shitzdorch La'atiro. When am I able to revoke a vow that the public consented to? When the public knew going in that there is the potential that they may need to revoke it at some point later on. Now, how does that work for the case of the rapist? Because they know no dalachol shenother zehu bittel mitzvah, they nesaram chalalav. You know, actually, I'll one up you. It's not simply that they want to revoke it one day, but actually, it's that they know that if they accept this man's neder, not to benefit from this woman who he's supposed to be married to, it's going to prevent him from performing a mitzvah zaseh. That's not something I want my name on. I'm not signing off on any, you know, figurative documents where I am preventing somebody from fulfilling a mitzvah say. So not only is it simply that I'm able to revoke the nether, actually, arguably, the nether never took effect. It was never chal to begin with because the public would not want to prevent somebody from performing a mitzvah. So that there's a lot of other things to delve into, but the hour's late, went 10 minutes early, so we could all get some good sleep and have energy to learn and perform mitzvahs tomorrow. Yasher Koach, everyone. Thank you for coming in person and on Zoom. Have a wonderful night. Pleasure learning together as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good job, Shabbos.
By the way, the internet seemed to work better tonight.
I'm using my own data. That's why. As you can tell, you see the angle here is different. I'm using my phone. So because my computer requires Wi-Fi, I'm using my phone. Mm-hmm. Hopefully my phone survives. I'm hoping that we get Wi-Fi here soon before my phone crumbles. All right.
Good night.
Thank you, Rich.